offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, and I have the pleasure of joining you from our studios, Sri Sathya Sai Media Center, from Prashanthi Nilayam. And as always, we are here to resume our journey together, our pilgrimage together through the Bhagavad Gita. And I'm ever so grateful to all of you for giving me the pleasure of your company. And truly speaking, this is not an exposition on the Gita. I'm not telling you or giving you a discourse on the Gita. That's not how I would like to look at this program. And I would look at this program as rather me trying to look at the Gita and learn and pick up pearls of wisdom from it. Even as I have the joy of your company, I'm doing it with all of you. I'm certainly not an expert who's sharing my wisdom with all of you. We are using Swami's Gita Vahini and the many other discourses that Swami has given. And through that, we are trying to pick up lessons from the Gita. And most importantly, as Swami would always say, the whole idea is to internalize these lessons and make them reflect in the way we lead our lives. And I think that's the most important thing. Many times going through the Gita and going through spiritual literature, going through Swami's discourses, you're left overwhelmed with this feeling, Swami, what am I doing with my life? Am I leading it the way that I'm supposed to lead it? Am I leading it in a way that will make you happy with how I'm doing it? Though that could be a depressing thought sometimes, but I think it is better to be worried and to be disturbed with such thoughts than to be disturbed with thoughts of the world. Am I making enough money? Am I doing well in my business? What happened to my promotion? What happened to my children? Instead of such thoughts worrying us, this is a better worry to have. Am I leading my life in a way that Swami would want me to? And this worry, this self-reflection can only lead to good. It can only result in us taking one firm step forward in the spiritual journey. So that is something that we all have to keep doing. And even as we go through these various chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, hopefully we keep that flame burning. That flame through which we look at our lives and say, this is where I can correct it. Nothing changes overnight. Certainly, our nature is not going to change overnight, but in small, small changes, like a rock being chipped into smaller rocks bit by bit, I think our life will be shaped and made in a manner that it would please Swami. I think that should be our prayer, that should be our endeavor. We began the ninth chapter last week. The chapter is called Raja Vidya Guhya Yoga. As we saw, this is a continuation of the discourse on Jnana Vijnana that Krishna started in the seventh chapter. We covered the first two verses, and the chapter begins with Krishna saying, to you, O Arjuna, who are not given to envy, I shall speak of this highest secret. Which is with Jnana and Vijnana, right? That's the statement that Krishna opens this chapter with. And he says, this knowledge will liberate you from everything that is inauspicious, everything that is unpleasant. Ashubhat is the word that he uses. We discussed about this feeling of asuya, not having envy. Anasuya is not having envy, asuya is envy. And how this asuya represents all impurities in the heart. And when Krishna tells Arjuna, you have anasuya, for us, it is a message as to what is the prerequisite for the path that Krishna is describing here as Raja Yoga. We must try to develop this purity, which is referred to as anasuya. We had a discussion about that. It is not something which is alien to us. We just need to observe our mind when we are jealous of somebody and what that creates in our mind, what causes and what effects it causes in the way we carry out our life. That is what needs to be observed, and that needs to be corrected, that needs to be restrained, right? That's what will lead to anasuya. We also saw what it means when Krishna says, but now I will tell you something different. I'm going to teach you something different, right? Because in the previous chapter, which was called Akshara Parabrahma Yoga, he speaks of the Supreme as being Akshara, immutable, as being incomprehensible, beyond the accessibilities of the mind. After having described the Lord like that, how do you make it more real to you in your life, right? Krishna says, that is what I'm going to talk about. In the second verse, Krishna says, this Raja Vidya, Raja Guhyam, is most purifying. It is in line with Dharma. It is Pratyakshavagamam. It is realizable directly. It is comprehensible. Susukham Kartum, very easy to undertake. And the knowledge that is got from it is Avyayam. It is imperishable. So we discussed what this could mean, and we also fell back upon, as always, on Swami's words, where Swami explained that Raja Yoga is nothing but a synthesis of bhakti and karma, carrying out one's duties in life as a form of worship. A devotee is supposed to worship the Lord that he loves and adores, and the entire duty that one performs, or one is asked to perform, one is supposed to perform, all of that becomes part of this worship that the devotee is offering to his Lord, is his or her favorite deity, right? That is what is bhakti. So Swami says Raja Yoga is this bhakti and that karma coming together. Speaking about the importance of what is said in this Raja Yoga, what, in fact, Raja Yoga is nothing but what Krishna is trying to establish as the duty that Arjuna has to perform and how it has to be performed. Mam anusmara yuddhyacha is a very important statement that he made in the previous chapter. This is what Krishna expects of Arjuna. This is what Krishna expects of each one of us, that we continue our duties but continue constantly remembering the Lord. Swami speaks of three pathways of sadhana and explains where this concept of Raja Yoga fits in that. Swami says, this is there in a couple of discourses. It is from a discourse that I made references to last week, the 1979 summer course. Swami has spoken about it in later years also. So the three paths are, the first of the three paths are Matsya Marga, or it is also called Meena Marga, as the name suggests. It is the path of the fish. The second is Mriga Marga, the path of the animal. And the last one is Kurma Marga, or the path of the tortoise. There are different ways of explaining it, and we will see maybe one way that is applicable to our discussion that we've been having since last week. Swami says, the fish can live only in water and will die if it is taken out. So those that follow the Matsya Marga are those who can perform sadhana only when in the company of others. They need that good company to stick to the spiritual path. So this path is sometimes referred to as tamasic, because you do not do what you do by your own self, but by the prodding and the presence of others around you. Right? So one marga is sadhana, or one marga is the Matsya Marga of sadhana, where one is required to be in society, one needs to be in a noble family, one needs to be among good friends to be able to stick to sadhana. Then Swami says comes the Mriga Marga, the path of the animal, which is just the opposite. The animal will die when put into water. It will live only when it is out of water, which means people who follow this path are people who need solitude to perform sadhana. They cannot focus when in a family, when in society, when there are people around. So these people are rajasic by nature, right? And these people are the ones who tend to think that spirituality means leaving society, leaving home. One needs to be in the forest in solitude. The aspiration is the same, right? Even this person is a spiritual person. He or she is also trying to perform sadhana. But the nature of such a person is rajasic, because one thinks that when in company, I cannot do sadhana, I need solitude. Swami says the third one, the Kurma Marga, is the amphibian, which can survive in water and on land. And Swami says people who take to this path can practice their sadhana whether in society or even in solitude. They can continue to do their duties and still perform their sadhana without any problem whatsoever. And Swami clearly states the Raja Yoga that Krishna is speaking about here is, as Swami explained, is the fusion of karma and bhakti, where when you are in the society, when you're performing your duties, you are able to still continue your sadhana by making your actions as themselves a form of worship. If it so happens that you have to be in solitude, even then you can continue to do your sadhana, maybe in the form of meditation, maybe in the form of some penance, right? Whatever the case may be. So Swami says that we as devotees must learn to embrace this Kurma Marga, the path of the tortoise. We should be able to be spiritual, whether we are in the family, whether we are in the middle of an official setup, or we are in the middle of friends, or when we are left alone, right? That is why this Raja Yoga is very important. That is why the bringing in of bhakti in trying to meditate upon the Lord, as after having described the Lord as being Akshara, as being incomprehensible, as being Achintaniya, right, is one of the beautiful descriptions that Krishna gave. How do you think of him who is Achintaniya? That is what bhakti tries to teach us. So we will go to the third verse. We'll listen to that. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. I think last time I played the third verse by mistake. So today only we're going to discuss the third verse. So I'll play that third verse again and then we'll discuss and take it forward from there.
Ashraddhanah purushah dharmasyasya parantapa aprapyamam nivartante mrityu samsara vartmani.
Men devoid of faith in dharma, O scorcher of foes, ever remain without attaining me in the mortal pathway of samsara. That's the third verse of the ninth chapter. As we saw, Krishna had said that he will now talk about something that is more accessible to the mind. If we were to go through the whole chapter, we will see that it is pretty much a description of God, which is very similar to what has been given so far. Nothing very different from that. We will see that the concepts are also quite repetitive in a sense. That is why this angle of seeing this chapter as introducing the idea of developing devotion for God as a more accessible path makes a little more sense. Right, we will be going through the same descriptions that we have heard in the previous chapters, but as being now having spoken of God as being incomprehensible, now Krishna is introducing the idea of worshipping in a form, in a name, and how that changes or how that should mature the devotion that you have towards God and what happens when this maturity of devotion is reached, right? In that context, we will see whatever are the verses that are to come. And there will also be references to how even Krishna as an avatar fits into this idea that we are building. Generally, when we speak of the Gita, they would say, oh, when Krishna speaks about jnana, he says jnana is the highest. When he is speaking about bhakti, he says bhakti is the best. When he is talking about karma, he says nothing like karma yoga. He is contradicting himself, he is confusing. As we can see from this idea that I just spoke about, clearly that is not the case. Jnana alone can remove sorrow. There is no change in that, right? The right understanding of who we really are will only put an end to attachment and sorrow. That is what Krishna said right in the beginning in the second chapter. He diagnoses the cause for Arjuna's sorrow. And he says, your sorrow can be removed only if this attachment is removed, and attachment is removed only by correcting one's vision. That is nothing but jnana, right? So jnana alone can remove false identification with the body. Jnana alone can ensure that we break free from the cycle of life and death. But the means to attain that, or one of the easy means, pleasurable means, dharmic means, as we saw in the previous verse, of attaining this jnana is Raja Yoga, combining of karma and bhakti. As Swami had said in the Gita Vaini, when through bhakti and karma one tries to sanctify life, the gift that is bestowed on him or her is this jnana. There is no contradiction whatsoever in what Krishna is saying here. If we take chapters as standalones and read them, I think that is where we get confused. But when we see this entire concept that Krishna is building, we can see how beautifully everything falls into place like a complex jigsaw puzzle, which is not so complex after all when you look at it in the right way. So Krishna continues in this chapter the description of the Supreme Lord. But in this verse, after having spoken of the Raja Yoga or Raja Vidya, he quickly tells what happens to those who do not follow this path. He says, Parantapa, O scorcher of foes, which is an appellation for Arjuna that he has used many times before, O Parantapa, Ashraddhadanaha Purushaha, those men who do not have Shraddha, Ashraddhadanaha Purushaha, Asya Dharmasya, on this Dharma, those who do not have faith on this Dharma, Aprapyamam, without attaining me, Nivartante, they return. Where do they return to? Mrityu Samsara Vartmani, in the path of this world of death. When you follow the Raja Yoga, it is easy, it is pleasurable, and it is certain to take you to that supreme knowledge that liberates. If you don't follow this path, in that case also your fate is quite certain. There is certainty in following the path, there is certainty when you don't follow the path as well. As Krishna had said in the previous chapter, both pathways are eternal, because both pathways have always been there and the results they produce have always been the same. At no time in this period when the creation has been around, following the path of bhakti, following the path of spirituality, one has been doomed. Following the path of the world, one has been redeemed. That has never been the case. So Krishna is saying here, if you do not follow the Raja Yoga, what happens to you is also certain. This is not as a means, as we have discussed before. Krishna is not punishing the devotee or punishing the individual and saying that if you don't follow this, this is what will happen to you. The analogy that I've given many times before and I keep giving again and again, you go to a doctor with a stomach ailment and the doctor will tell you, don't eat spicy food. If you don't listen to the doctor and go and eat spicy food, it doesn't mean the next day the doctor is going to come and kick you in your stomach. Your own stomach is going to hurt because you have disobeyed the doctor. The same way, Krishna is not telling that I will punish you if you don't follow the Raja Yoga. If you don't follow the Raja Yoga, this is what is going to happen. If you don't follow this path, Krishna says, the other path will not lead you to me, aprapyamam, without attaining me. And then you fall upon, you return, nivartante, to the world. And again, a very interesting word or an adjective which Krishna uses for this world. He says, mrityu samsara vartmani. Vartman means path or road. Mrityu samsara. Mrityu means death. But when Krishna says mrityu here, it means birth and death, right? But mrityu kind of gives it a very grim feeling, right? Mrityu samsara, if you say, oh, it's a death, a samsara or a existence where death is certain, right? That's what is the idea that is being conveyed. Mrityu samsara. Samsara, as we know, is a worldly life, but it's a very interesting word. The word samsara is very closely associated with another word, samsarati, right? Samsara comes from samsarati. Samsarati means to simply wander, to wander without any purpose, to wander listlessly. That's why samsara is to be lost without any purpose. We are in this world of birth and death, lost without having an eye on the purpose of life. That is what is referred to as samsara. Samsara does not, as we generally in Indian languages say, someone is married, he is in samsara. No. Even if you are married, even if you have 10 children, you need not necessarily be in samsara if you are leading a purposeful life towards the goal. Samsara means samsarati, the one who is leading life listlessly without purpose. Right? So Krishna says, Mrityu samsara. Mrityu samsara vartmani. That path which is circular, which is perpetual, which will take you around in this life listlessly. Nivartante mrityu samsara vartmani. You return to the path that leads you to this listless existence of birth and death. How does one break free then? Krishna said in the first line of the shloka, he said, Ashraddha dhanaha purushaha. Those men who do not have faith, asya dharmasya, on this dharma, they will be put to this fate. Dharma is not a new word for us, but as we had discussed just last week, dharma is also used for that lifestyle that ensures that you are on the course to fulfill the purpose of life. So dharma is something like a philosophy of life that we adapt and commit to, right? If you think of it, we all have a unique philosophy of life, and each one of us, consciously or unconsciously, are living by it. Because part of that philosophy is kind of hardwired into our head, that is what we refer to as vasanas. Right? Even the most worldly person has a philosophy of life. It's not that they don't have philosophies in life. They have a philosophy, what is that? That life is meant to enjoy all kinds of pleasures. That is their philosophy in life. Or you have a philosophy in life called YOLO. You only live once, so live your life to the fullest. That's a philosophy of life. So for him or her, the philosophy in life is meant to be enjoyed. Someone who wishes to make a lot of money, let's say through hard work, wants to become very rich and become very well endowed and have good name in society, their philosophy in life is, this is what life is meant to achieve, or this is what life is meant to be used for, right? And this philosophy is not very simple. It is not a one-line philosophy. It is actually quite complex. With different priorities and different situations, our philosophies change, compromises come in, so on and so forth. And most of us also modify this philosophy as we go through life, based on life experiences and the people whom we meet, whom we have trust in, whom we adore, whose words we respect, and also from books, right? These are all different sources through which our philosophies in life are changing. Social media is changing our philosophy of life drastically, whether we admit it or not. Let us say that you all of a sudden happen to come across a book on, say, Scientology or some atheistic theology like that. And the arguments are presented very well. And the person who is saying these or has written this book is a person of eminence who has otherwise, been very successful in the field of science or field of politics or something. And the arguments are presented in a way that you're not able to refute them. Then you will start making a change to this philosophy, or you will try to accommodate what is being said into your philosophy of life, and accordingly your approach to life will also modify in some way. Till this philosophy is challenged by another person whom you give more credence to, right? There are many people whose thinking had changed drastically after coming to Swami. Many of them who came as atheists, many of them who came as communists. But after coming to Swami and after seeing Swami, after listening to Swami's words, they changed. What exactly happens then? I place my faith on someone else's philosophy. I'm speaking of Swami as just another person indulge me for a moment. So here is Swami telling me something, and I am listening to it from him. I have developed faith in him, so I try to accommodate this philosophy that he is presenting into my own approach to life. Now you're sitting and listening to me. In a sense, I am sharing my philosophy of life with you. Of course, I'm trying hard not to let my ideas come in and only Swami's message is conveyed. That's part of my struggle, and probably you don't know that or you don't acknowledge that as much. But you are listening to me, and in a way, I am trying to influence your philosophies in life with my understanding. If what I say makes sense, unconsciously you are placing your faith on my words and making these ideas part of your philosophy of life. And as a speaker, I'm hoping that that is happening, right? And this philosophy of life will either be corrected or strengthened or fine-tuned through the life experiences that we undergo. And this is a process that happens all the time. It is happening right now. And this faith, which leads to action, is what is referred to as Shraddha. Shraddha is not just faith. Shraddha is faith which results in a form of perseverance. That is why Shraddha, you would often see when you read translations of shlokas, Shraddha is translated as faith. It is also translated as perseverance. Even in Swami's discourses, if you read Satyasai Speaks, you'll find this. Because Shraddha is not just faith, but it is faith that has resulted in some form of commitment, in some form of persevering action. And we often do this mistake of thinking that it is experience that leads to faith. That is certainly not the case. Swami has made this point many, many times. First, there is faith, then you act upon it, and then the experience that is had corrects, strengthens, or fine-tunes this philosophy of life. In a way, this is where devotion also comes into play. Why am I sitting here and telling you about the Gita? And why are you listening to me, of all people? Because I have faith in Swami, and he has endorsed the Gita. I have taken up the study of the Gita. You are listening to me for the same reason. You have faith in Swami, and you are listening to me for the same reason. And you have faith in Swami, and maybe you feel this is Swami's student who is speaking, and that makes you listen to me, isn't it? Otherwise, who is Prem and why will you listen to him? Where there is faith, commitment is easy. That is what is referred to as Shraddha. You will be ready to modify your philosophy of life, and when you do that, you will have your own experience, and that experience will strengthen this faith. If not today, you will have that experience tomorrow, but you are bound to have that experience. This, I know, is a pretty much a repetition of what we discussed, especially where that statement comes, Shraddhavan Labhate Jnanam, there we had spoken about this. But I think many times on the spiritual path, we are likely to lose our way. We are not able to do with interest the sadhana that we have taken up. The problem always lies here. Our mind gets carried away by someone else's philosophy, and that is where we are not able to find that same commitment in action. And this correction of vision is something that we have to keep doing periodically. Should I trust the words of this rich man, that management guru, this writer, this author, this bestseller, this good meaning but not very wise friend, or should I trust the words of Swami? This is a question that we must keep putting to ourselves, because whenever we find that our sadhana is becoming a little loose and we are losing our way, we try to gather our actions together. But what is actually missing is this correction of our philosophy of life is getting diluted because of maybe our reading, maybe our speaking and discussing with others. So the correction has to happen in the mind, not necessarily in the body level. So Krishna clearly states in the shloka, those that lack this Shraddha are those that lose their way into the Mrityu Samsara Vartmani. Before we move to the next verse, I would like to quote just one statement that Swami makes about this portion of the Gita, which is very important And a very subtle point too. Swami says, asuya or jealousy should be completely rooted out of the human heart, and shraddha or perseverance should be cultivated instead. This is from the 26th chapter of the 1979 Samashava's book that I made references to even last week. The discourse itself is about this chapter of the Gita. In the first verse of this chapter, Krishna had said, Arjuna, because you don't have asuya, I am going to teach you this. Here in this verse, Krishna says, those who do not have faith lose their way. Swami beautifully puts the two together and says, asuya must be replaced with shraddha. Instead of being jealous of another's achievement, I should be prepared to work hard. I should persevere myself with faith and make myself worthy of that achievement. Right? That is the exact opposite of asuya. When I am jealous of somebody, as we discussed last week, instead of saying, me working on myself, I will only be saying why I am worthy of that situation, of that accolade or that achievement more than the person I'm jealous of. So the opposite of that is, there is something lacking in me, so what can I work on it and how can I work on it to ensure that I get there? So that is why Swami puts the two together and very beautifully says, asuya must be replaced with shraddha. Shraddha should be cultivated in the place where you have weeded out asuya. Swami says in that same discourse, a man who has no faith in himself cannot have faith in God. Self-confidence and faith in God are always found in juxtaposition. They complement each other. A very, very important statement that Swami is making. So for reaching God, I must first want to break from the cycle of samsara, have faith in this dharma or way of life, this philosophy of life taught in the scriptures. And when I say faith, I should be able to take it and make it a means by which it reflects in my life. And without being distracted by others, that is where asuya comes in. And I should be able to persevere with self-confidence. It is not enough if I have faith in Swami's words alone. My faith in Swami's words is connected to the faith in my own abilities, what we refer to as self-confidence. So that is why Swami says self-confidence and faith are complementary. I should have faith in Swami's words. I must have confidence in my own ability to follow those words and reach the goal. And summarizing this entire part, Swami says in the Gita Vahini, and I quote, only the one who has faith in this wisdom, who is devoted to acquiring it, and who is full of yearning to earn it, can realize me. One must be free from envy. Besides, one must be earnest and steeped in faith, shraddha. Earnestness is essential for the performance of even the smallest act. Not humans alone, but birds and bees, worms and viruses all have to be earnest to succeed. When you have no earnestness or faith in the act, you cannot gather the fruit. End of quote. So this is from the 18th chapter of the Gita Vahini, where Swami very beautifully summarizes this entire section of what are the prerequisites to be able to walk on this path, which is referred to as Raja Yoga. We will go to the next verse, the fourth verse. We'll listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss in detail.
Maya tadamidam sarvam jagadavyakta murtina matsthani sarva bhutani nachaham teshva vasthitaha.
This whole world is pervaded by me in my unmanifest form. All beings exist in me, but I am not contained in them. That is the fourth verse of the ninth chapter. Krishna is reiterating a few points that he had made earlier, in the beginning of the 7th chapter to be precise, where he spoke about para prakriti, apara prakriti, and how all beings are part of this eightfold prakriti of his, the five bhutas, the pancha bhutas, and mano, buddhi and ahankara. All of this are part of that apara prakriti nature of his, right? So in a sense, this is a reiteration of that. Again, this is a shloka that we can see from the point of view of devotion. It is not directly appealing in that manner. There are some verses in the Gita where you read it and you say, okay, this is about bhakti. This is not necessarily a shloka like that. But as I said, though the statements being made are very similar, if we look at it from this viewpoint that Krishna is introducing bhakti, the way we will look at it will be quite different. So what is that starting stage of bhakti and how is that relatable to what Krishna is saying here? As we saw last week, the inscrutable divine is being made comprehensible, relatable and lovable by attributing a name and form to that entity, right? That's what we refer to as upasana. And as we saw, but at no time the true nature must ever be forgotten. Even though you're attributing a name and form, this fundamental nature is never lost sight of. I think this shloka and the following shlokas can be seen from this point of view, and I'll explain that in the next few minutes. Krishna says here, Maya tatamidam sarvam jagat, meaning Maya, by me, tatam, is pervaded idam sarvam jagat, all this world. But how is he pervading this entire world? Avyakta murtina. The word murti means form or embodiment of. We often use phrases such as avatara murti, karuna murti, Leela Murti to describe Swami, right? If you listen to some of the Vedic scholars or Telugu pundits, you will see them using these words. So you refer to Swami as an embodiment of compassion, right? An embodiment of love and mercy. These qualities don't have a form by themselves, compassion and love and kindness. But we say that if they had a form, then it would be Swami, right? The word Murti is, we are referring to God as an embodiment or concentration of some of these invisible qualities. But here Krishna is saying something that is quite interesting. He says, I pervade this entire world in avyakta murtina. As the avyakta murti. Avyakta is actually the opposite of murti. Avyakta itself means that which cannot be individualized as a vyakti. That is what is avyakta. Avyakta means that which is not a vyakti, that which is not an individual entity. So he says, in that unmanifest form, Krishna is saying, as avyakta murti, I pervade this entire world. As the embodiment of formlessness, I pervade this entire world. I think the way this is, this has to be seen is, because we know what is manifestation, we also know what is unmanifest. The computer before me is manifest, and I know it because I can see it, I can interact with it. So I know that when I say there is no computer in front of me, I am able to speak of something that is unmanifest because I know what it is when a computer is in front of me, right? So we speak of avyakta on the basis of vyaktitva. We know what it is to have an individual in front of us. So we are describing God's presence as that which is not similar to having an individual right in front of us whom we can see and interact with. The other way of looking at it is, I am not present as any one vyakti. I am not present as Krishna, as Rama or Sai Baba. I am not present in this entire world as that one Vyakti that you look at. I pervade this entire universe in my true form. What is that? That form which cannot be pinned to any form. That is my true form, and I pervade this entire universe in that form. I was listening to an old talk by Dr. Hislop a couple of days back, and he was describing this very beautiful, simple incident, but a more profound interaction that followed after the incident. He was once called to give a lecture to the overseas devotees in Prashanthi Nilayam, and they had requested him for a question and answer session. So after one of the morning sessions in the mandir, they had this satsang in, I'm guessing it must have been the EHV building. And which is the EHV building? This very place I'm sitting in right now. Because before it became the studios of Radio Sai, this very building was the satsang hall of the ashram. Right? So Dr. Hisla, Professor Kasturi and all of these people used to give satsangs and talks in this hall. In fact, we are going to be playing a talk from our archives this evening too, and it is from, it is a talk that was delivered in this very place. So that apart, so Dr. Hislop was having a question answer session with these overseas devotees. Later that day, or I think the next day, he is sitting in the mandir and Swami comes and calls him and another devotee for an interview. And Swami looks at him and asks him, what did you speak yesterday? You completely confused all the people there. Right? This is how Swami starts the conversation. And Swami said, why did you speak so much about Vedanta? And even as I'm saying this, I'm wondering what Swami is going to be telling about the Gita series. Right? We are all the time talking about Vedanta. But the saving grace comes in the next statement. Because Swami says, instead of confusing people with all this Vedanta, why don't you speak Swami's message? Right? And Swami said, no, first of all, you're speaking about Vedanta, which is so high and dry, and these people have no idea of Vedanta, and they're asking you questions, and your answers have confused them even further. And then Swami went on to give some very specific conversations and discussions that were held as part of that meeting. So Hislop heard this, he got the message, and you know, he kind of knew what he had to do when he next time goes to speak to an audience. But then Hislop looks at Swami and says, but Swami, how did you know exactly what happened in that hall, which is quite far away from this mandir? You were behind the walls in this mandir. How did you know what happened behind the walls in that satsang hall? It is not that Dr. Hislop did not know about Swami's divinity, but he was asking a very specific question. He was asking Swami, Swami, in what form were you present in that hall? Were you present in the form of some person there, or were you present as Ishvara? And to that question, Swami said, no, Dr. No, Hislop, I am at all places as the universal consciousness. That is his true form, isn't it? He is not present as a person. We read stories in the life of Shirdi Baba where he comes in the form of a dog. He comes in the form of a dog so that we can recognize, or in the form of a devotee, in the form of a beggar, so that we can recognize the presence. But he pervades the entire universe, not in the form of a dog, not in the form of a beggar, not even the form of Satya Sai or Shirdi Sai, but in the form of this universal consciousness, Avyaktamurtina, as the embodiment of that which cannot be embodied. I suffuse this entire universe. Right? So when we say pervaded, that is what it means. But when we use this word pervaded, we may think that the relationship between the creation and God is that of the container and the contained. The same statement is made in the verse, in the very first verse of a very popular Upanishad, right? That most of you may be familiar with. Most of you might even be chanting every day, Isha Vasya Midam Sarvam Yat Kincha Jagatyam Jagat. All things of this world, the transitory, the evanescent, are pervaded by the Lord who is the true reality of each. Isha Avasyam, Isha Vasyam is split into Isha Avasyam Idam Sarvam. All that is seen is a container or is filled with that Supreme Lord. So we think that the relationship between the various forms that we see in creation, the bhutaha that we see, the relationship between these beings, these forms and God is, they are the containers and the form is the contained. They are the avasyam and Isha is contained and they are, the complex is called Isha avasyam. So that we do not get into this misconception of the relationship between creation and the creator. In the very next line, Krishna says, Matsthani sarvabhutani. All beings exist in me, are contained in me. Nacha aham teshu avasthitaha. But I am not contained in them. Now this appears to be a contradiction to what Krishna said just in the previous line. In the first line he said, Maya tadamidam sarvam jagat. The whole world is pervaded by me. And in the very next line Krishna says, but I am not contained by them. They are contained in me. If this is not confusing enough, wait till you listen to the next shloka. And I'll play the next shloka for you and just listen to what Krishna says in the very first line or the first half of the first line in the next shloka. And I will tell you how this contradiction becomes even more deep when you listen to that.
Na cha matsthani bhutani pashya me yoga maishwaram bhuta bhrinna cha bhutastho mamatma bhuta bhavanah.
Nor do the beings dwell in me. Behold my divine yoga. I am the sustainer and the originator of beings, but myself is not contained in the beings. What did Krishna say in the previous verse? Matsthani sarvabhutani. All beings exist in me. And what is he saying here? Nacha matsthani bhutani. And nor do all beings exist in me. Matsthani sarvabhutani. Nacha matsthani bhutani. I do not exist in the beings and the beings do not exist in me. And if that is not enough, he says, Pashya me yogam aishwaram. Pashya, behold, me, my yogam aishwaram, my divine yoga. What is the meaning of yoga? It is union, right? So Krishna is seeing, see this connection, this divine connection between me and my creation. Yoga can also mean glory, right? So see this glory of mine. Neither am I contained in them, nor are they contained in me. Before we go to the second line, let us address this contradiction here. I mean, this is an open contradiction. I just told you that some people say that there is contradiction between chapters. There is a contradiction within one shloka itself. So how do we resolve this? If you recall, we had a discussion on this conundrum that Vedanta faces. There is no one analogy that can tell us clearly the relationship between God and the creation. Sometimes we speak of it as ocean and waves. Sometimes we say clay and pot. Sometimes we speak of space inside the pot and outside the pot. All these examples and analogies are limited. And that is why all of them convey the idea to a certain extent, but none of them can be comprehensive. But in these two verses, I think a very interesting and important subtle process is being pointed out. When I worship an idol, or even I worship Swami, that 5 feet 3 inch form, what is the idea there? What is the idea of worship or upasana? I feel that that physical frame contains divinity. Or the idol made up of stone or panchaloha or some metal contains God, right? That is why we direct our worship and love towards that object. We shower all our worship on that form. Tyagaraja cried when his Rama statue was thrown into the river, as though Rama himself was thrown. Mirabai would dance with her Krishna statue as though she was dancing with her Krishna himself. The same Tyagaraja only sang, as Swami would say, Chimalo, Brahmalo, Shivakeshava, Dulalo. You are in an ant, you are in Brahma, you are in Shiva, you are in Keshava, you are in all these celestial beings. Then why this obsession with the statue? That is because, yes, the Lord is present in all, but as Avyakta Murtina, in the imperceptible form. Is he there in the idol? Yes, he is there in the idol. Is he there in this 5 feet 3 inch form? Yes, he is there in that form. There is nothing wrong in worshipping that form because he is there. He is there as the Avyakta Murtina in not only that form, in all forms. So the first stage is to build this relationship. The first stage in this path to build this relationship is to pray to him as contained in one unitary form. And as we have seen many, many times already in the Gita, true devotion is about going to the next stage where you see the same God within yourself and within all beings. The basis of bhakti is that desire to be with the Lord who is the object of your love, not to be separated from the Lord, right? Vibhakti means to separate. Bhakti means to be together. So bhakti itself means that you want that union with the Lord. And as we saw, Krishna says, how does that union come about? When you start seeing God everywhere as the indweller of all beings and all objects that you interact with. I think that is what Krishna says here. The second stage is this, Maya tatamidam sarvam jagat avyakta murtina. You now start seeing him as being in everything. In other words, this whole world is suffused with the Lord that you have come to love. Now there is no difference between an idol and a simple rock. Some people have said this to me in some conversations and, you know, some of these discussions that we've had, that some of these other religions seem to be more advanced than Sanatan Dharma. You know, in Sanatan Dharma, we worship an idol and then we graduate to the worship of God as being formless. That is why we say, you know, the Karma Kanda, Upasana Kanda. And finally, when you come to the Jnana Kanda, when you come to the Upanishads describe the God as being avyakta, as being supreme, not having a form. So they say that it seems like some of these other religions that worship God as being formless, it looks like they're more advanced, right? Just worshipping God as being formless is not a higher state. When you say God is formless, that is also actually attributing a form to God. When you say God is light, it is attributing a form to God. When you say God is a burning bush, you are attributing a form to God. So worshipping God as being formless is not a higher state. Worshipping God as being formless and the inseparable indweller of all forms is the higher state. When Hiranyakashipu asked Prahlada, where is that Narayana? He said with confidence, he is everywhere. He is in you, he is in me, and he is in every object in this room. That attitude is the highest state of understanding we must go to, not merely saying God is formless. God is formless means every form is his. But even that is not the ultimate. That is the premise that is being placed here. I love Swami and I am trying to show you love by seeing Swami in you, right? When I'm trying to see Swami in you, that's what I'm saying. I love Swami, so I'm trying to love you by seeing that Swami in you. This is still in the stage of upasana. Whatever I do to an idol where I looked beyond the stone and metal and saw my Lord, I am now trying to do with you. I am trying to see beyond your body and personality and see God. That is also only upasana. But the relationship between all of creation and God, as I said, is not that of the container and the contained. It is far subtler than that. I had read this example somewhere when I was studying the shloka, so I will share the same analogy with you. It's quite simple and quite fascinating. But before we go to that analogy and conclude this episode, let me reiterate again what is the problem with seeing God as the contained or the indweller. It is not wrong to look at God that way. That is what Krishna himself has said, and Swami has also said many times, that God is your indweller. But that is still not the ultimate stage of understanding. When we say God is in me or God is in you, God being in you becomes like an attribute I am recognizing. But God's presence is not an attribute. God's presence is the fundamental truth. Existence is not an attribute. There is a house. So-and-so is in the house is a description of the present state of the house, right? I come to your house and I say, you are in your house. That is a description of the house, which is opposite of saying, I came to your house, you are not there. Again, that's a description of the house. Similarly, we think existence of God is an attribute. I look at you. Earlier, I didn't see Swami in you. Now I'm seeing Swami in you. So I'm speaking of existence of God or God being the indweller as an attribute. Vedanta is trying to correct our vision in such a way to make us see that existence is not an attribute. Existence is the truth, is the basis, and objects, individuals, names and forms are the attributes. You know, this is not going to be very straightforward to understand. That is why I felt that this analogy is quite interesting and gives a little bit of understanding. Nothing new. It is not going to be some life-changing, I mean, very, very different analogy. Instead of saying pots and clays, we're going to change it a little bit. But it kind of conveys that idea very beautifully. Let us say we have a gold chain before me. To the question, what is in the chain? The answer is gold. You have a gold chain in front of me. You're asking me what is in the chain. I say gold. So the relationship between the chain and gold is the chain is the container and gold is what is in it. Let us say I do a little modification to the chain. I break it up and make it into two bracelets. Does it in any way change the gold? No, it doesn't. So by my action, what can be changed, I changed, and that is only the form of the object. And with the form, what changed was the name of the object. From chain, it now became a bracelet, but it did not change the gold in it. Whatever I do, I cannot change the gold in it. You might say that I can melt it and add some silver to it, or I can add some other metal to it. But still, I cannot change the gold, isn't it? As a student of chemistry, if I have to put it, the atomic weight of gold, which will always remain 79, its melting point will not change, and that fundamental attributes of gold will not change. I might add other elements to it, but that does not change gold. Gold will always be gold. In other words, when I say gold chain, in general usage, gold is the attribute. What chain is it? It's a gold chain. It's pure gold. It's 24 karat gold or whatever. So we speak of gold as being an attribute and chain as being the substratum. We speak of gold being the attribute, very similar to God being an attribute. But if you really see, only the name and form, nama and rupa, change. The gold was once an ore, it became a nugget, it became a block of gold maybe, then it became a chain, it became a bracelet. Only names and forms changes, the gold never changed. In the same way, existence is not an attribute. What we refer to in Vedanta as isness. When I say, I am happy, I am sad, I am young, I am old, I am alive, These are all changes that happen on the substratum, I am. That I am-ness, that existence never changes, just like gold never changed. So in that sense, though all gold jewelry in the world is made by gold, the gold is in no way undergoing change or is in no way dependent on these names and forms. Even before we as a human race discovered gold, gold was same. It still had the same melting point, same, it had the same atomic number, the same attributes. So in our case, consider that isness or existence as gold. Today, a prem has been fashioned out of it. And as you say, prem is, and you add a quality to that and say, prem is boring us today. I hope you're not saying that, but suppose you're saying that. So tomorrow this prem, this entity, name and form called prem will melt away. With everything that you attach to prem is dash 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 will go with it. But existence will always remain. That existence is God. That existence is Sat. Will you agree now when I say God is not existent in me? This me called Prem, Prakash, Anand, Arvind, whatever the names you want to put, is a brief Nama Rupa existence in this substratum that is God. So now let us see the contradictory statements that Krishna has made in these two shlokas. Maya tatamidam sarvam jagat avyaktamurtina. This entire jagat is pervaded by me in the avyakta form, in the subtle unmanifest form. That's the first statement. Matsthani sarvabhutani nacha aham teshu avastitaha. All beings are contained in me. I am not contained in them. Here Krishna is setting right the relationship. I am not the contained. I am the container. I am the substratum. The whole universe, the creation is contained in me. And then he says, nacha matsthani bhutani. And the world is not contained in me. Because the creation is not separate from me to live in me. This nama rupa creation is only a brief illusory existence in the real existence that I am. And he says, Pashyame yogam ashwaram. Behold this divine yoga of mine. This is what is referred to as yoga maya. We are trying to establish and understand the relationship between God and his creation. Every religion comes in here. Every religion tries to explain this relationship between God and creation. And in trying to explain this relationship, it gives you ways and means of living life. But the problem with this is, God is real or satya, and creation is an illusion or mithya. There cannot be a relationship between the two. We can use various explanations like we are doing all through this discussion. Dreamer and the dreamer and his dream, the object and the shadow, the pot and the clay, all of these light and sun and all of these things that we can use. But none of this explains completely this relationship. So devotion finally leads to this understanding. That's what Krishna says, Pashyame yogam aishwaram. This is the ultimate truth, which has been spoken of in the previous chapter and the earlier chapters too. But to reach there, Krishna is clearly laying out the stages that can be followed. Pashyame means see my. It also means realize or understand. Pashyame yogam aishwaram. Understand this relationship between me and my creation. And this is the supreme understanding or jnana. Krishna summarizes that in the second line by saying, Mamatma, myself, Bhuta Bhavanaha, is the creator of all beings. Bhuta Bhrit is the supporter or sustainer of all beings. Nacha, and still not, Bhutastaha, a dweller in the beings. Right? So it's a very subtle way in which Krishna is laying out the path to reach that ultimate state from where we are stuck right now, right? I've taken a little bit of extra time, so I'll quickly wind up. Thank you, dear listeners, for being with me. We'll continue this, maybe a little more understanding of this shloka itself when we start next week. So thank you all for being with me. This has been a little complicated and a little more subtle, and I hope I've done justice to trying to convey to you what little I have been able to understand going through these verses. Do join me again next week for the resumption of this Gita pilgrimage. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.